Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the 7th annual Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. Will be taking place on Monday, April 15, at Monona Terrace Community and Convention Center in Madison. The theme of the conference is Conservation Everywhere, Sustaining Natural and Cultural Diversity. And people at the convention will be exploring all of the connections between biological diversity and human cultures, and also examining preservation across the whole range of environmental contexts, from forests and oceans to cities and farms. The one-day event will feature Dr. Jane Goodall, and she will be with us later this hour. Paul Robbins is also one of our guests this hour, and Paul is director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. The mission of the institute is to address environmental change. Paul has studied, particularly in India, human interactions with nature and the politics of natural resource management. He has taught environmental studies and natural resource policy and social theory. We'll be welcoming phone calls for both our guests during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We start with Paul Robbins. Hello, Paul. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great pleasure. You have said that the global environment is rapidly changing. There is no going back, and we need to be adaptive and innovative. Let's start with, how is the global environment changing and rapidly?
Well, for starters, we've got some built-in global change over the next century that includes some warming, both at the global level and then at the regional level. Whether it's 2.5 or 3 degrees warming globally or more is an open question, but things are getting hotter. Summer temperatures in Wisconsin are going to be warmer. You can imagine stress on water systems. So there's a lot of things that are going to happen no matter what we do in the next 50 to 70 years.
So we need to be adaptive and innovative. How do we adapt to that?
Well, we've got a lot of opportunities, and there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. Some of the things that we stress in this Earth Day conference, for example, is that different ways of looking at agriculture or doing agriculture can actually continue to produce food while maintaining things like biodiversity or soil quality. And if we move fast, we can even think about agriculture that uses water differently, which is going to be an incredibly important problem here in the state and across the country. We're in one of the longest, most sustained, and most expensive droughts in the country's history across the middle part of the country. I think we all know that. Thinking quickly and smart, I think we can adapt to change.
Now, when you talk about using water differently, does that tie into the work that you did in India? I'm interested in hearing about that.
Well, the work we're doing in India now has a great deal to do with places where agricultural landscapes, where we produce commodities like coffee that we drink in this country. They're exported. It's a major international export, but they demand all kinds of things. Water, they demand inputs, nutrients, fertilizer. They can be a really expensive, heavy footprint kind of agricultural system. And yet, in one of the fastest growing countries in the world, in a booming economy, these coffee plantations are producing an enormous diversity of wildlife. That's mammals and amphibians and bird life. And the question is, how can we maintain that, particularly if the environment around us is changing?
Mm-hmm.
So the research is really working with farmers to think about how to keep plants and animals on the land with commodity crops so that people can make a living.
And tell me in greater detail how they're able to do that, have this flourishing of mammals and bird life and all of that.
Well, it has a great deal to do with the production system. They mix. We've all heard of shade-grown coffee. What that simply means is that there's a range of tree species and shrubs and other plants which are mixed in around the coffee, which changes how the soil responds to sunlight. You can use less water. Mm. It creates habitat. At the same time, bumper crops of coffee. And that little things that are known pretty well, this is the cultural diversity question, things that are known well to producers already can be used as keys to open the door onto future agricultural systems.
Hmm. When we think of environmental action and the environment, really, we tend to think about wilderness areas. The conference will also address environmental issues in neighborhoods and in communities, including very densely populated urban areas. How will you look at that? How should we all look at that?
Well, a lot's happening. A lot of innovation is happening in this country already. If you look at a city like Detroit, whole blocks of the city have been reclaimed for agriculture. People are farming the city. This is that's kind of a remarkable transformation if we consider the Detroit of our imaginations versus the Detroit that's really happening on the ground. And this isn't a big plan by some major government action. This is local communities and local producers changing the land and the land use around them. So we can imagine farming the city. We can imagine changing our rooftops and the way our transportation systems work to make them just a little more weather ready. If there's a change in the weather or high kind of stress events, we can imagine a city that's built and ready for them. And that's something that happens, you know, within municipal planning already around the country, but also happens at the very local or neighborhood scale, or even the household scale, where people think about how they garden or manage their lawns or backyards for native biodiversity.
Let's go back to Detroit for a moment, which is very interesting. Who started that? How did that happen in Detroit?
Well, I'm by no means an expert. We do have some great faculty here on campus in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and here in the Nelson Institute who work with communities doing agriculture in Detroit. But for the most part, these are people who've been on the land quite a while. This agricultural transition, by my understanding, is quite old, that it began to move in as the city itself became depopulated in the last few decades. Mm. And there's several organizations within this state and around the region, around the upper Midwest, who've really helped galvanize that movement, movements like Growing Power, which I think you may have heard of, right?
Oh, sure.
That's an example, really, of a very grassroots change in the way that agriculture is occurring, some coordination between communities, get people good information about soils and plants and what they can grow. So some of it has happened piecemeal, individuals making pretty smart and creative decisions in the midst of real hardship. And then part of it is, you know, social activism, putting people together, getting together to come up with practical solutions.
Dr. Goodall, as you know, will be with us the second half hour and is your keynote speaker. She has written a piece, which I found interesting, about what gives her hope in the world. There is a tendency, I think, for some to become overwhelmed by global warming, by huge storms that have taken place, by droughts in the Midwest, a whole host of reasons to be concerned because we feel as though the pace of change and looking at things differently and taking action is not keeping up to the extent of the problem. She says she has great hope because of our brains, because of young people. Do you have hope, or are you understandably deeply concerned about everything?
Well, you could be concerned and have hope, I guess. We're a glass half full institute, though, because we think that many of the things that we have to do to change, we want to do anyway. There are win-win kinds of solutions where if you increase efficiencies in the way you grow food or the way you move a transportation system, you get a powerful and growing economy even while you're lightening the footprint on the earth. So I feel like I'm basically optimistic. I think we are an innovative species. The pessimism for me comes not from the end of the world, some kind of huge catastrophe that will bring a close to the chapter of human history, but instead that some people bear the brunt of these changes more than others. So there are people who live in island nations in the South Pacific who are literally losing real estate as we speak, as the sea levels rise. And they often are the most vulnerable, but they have some of the least political power to enact the kinds of changes that are going to be necessary to hold back some of the global change that we see. So my pessimism comes on the side of unfairness or injustice around environmental change. My optimism comes from the species genius and the local genius that people have in their communities and where they live.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a movement? Do you see an investment by this government, by other world governments that perhaps you want to draw attention to, an investment in green energy, an investment in fundamentally changing the way we operate?
There has been significant investments around the world in reimagining the energy system in particular. If you take a look at the innovations that are occurring in parts of Germany, Freiburg, Madison's sister city, is a green paradise with solar energy and digesters that run on waste. I mean, entirely new ways of thinking about the energy economy. And some of those innovations come from creative government interventions. Some of them come from solutions that come from the private sector. Usually it's a combination. So I do see a lot of change. I think that most of the innovative change, the really exciting innovative change in the United States so far, has been at the municipal scale. That is cities. Cities getting ready for what they know they're going to have to deal with, change in infrastructure. The federal movement on these things is just kind of turning the corner after the last election cycle. And so we'll see.
So why is it that cities are at the forefront of change?
I think they start to do the books. If you do some simple calculations about what things are going to cost you, and that's what cities think about all the time, and the populations they have to serve, they innovate pretty fast. Seattle is an interesting example. It's kind of, you'd predict it to be on the leading edge because it's kind of got a greeny reputation, but most of the people who are doing the innovation in the city government are engineers. They're looking at their wastewater. They're looking at where their power is going to come from. They're looking at how to manage trade in and out of the city. And that drives them to move fast because they can see costs on the horizon. If the average temperature of a city goes up from a heat island effect by several degrees, you're going to have, in the Southwest, you're going to have huge costs in terms of energy to cool the city. Dealing with water runoff and major storm events, look at New York City. Look at all the coastal governors and coastal mayors who came out just last year in the wake of the superstorm and said, you know, maybe we should be thinking about this. And that's because they're exposed. They're kind of frontline players.
Well, isn't there a part of you that says, oh, my gosh, this storm was just horrendous. We really need to rebuild everything. And aren't we worried about having to live through many, many more of these? How in the world can we do that?
Well, that's a huge question, I guess. That's the question I think that we're going to need to answer, not just with better engineering and better science, but we're going to have to make some values decisions and some trade-off decisions. People like property that's on the sea. And when they have that, they put themselves at risk. Mm-hmm. When communities reconstruct after these kinds of events, it's actually there's an opportunity here to sit down collectively and say, what do we want this city to look like? How exposed do we want to be to risk? And this isn't just citizens. This includes companies. If you look at what Dow Chemical is doing on the Gulf Coast, working with the Nature Conservancy to infill wetlands that have been destroyed over long periods of time, they're thinking about their exposure to those storms. And they're thinking about them because they're worried about capital investments that they've made on the coast that are at risk from hard weather. So these storms provide openings for real conversations about what we want.
And let's go back for a moment to those people on those South Pacific islands. Have any of those people had to relocate? If not, when will they have to do so? And who makes plans for being able to save people once their islands are gone?
What a great question. Many of these nations are making plans right now, and many of them are trying to get the world's attention. Since most of them are sovereign, many of these countries are sovereign nations and quite small, they have taken their case really to the global community. They've gone before the UN and before other international bodies and said, here's the nature of our exposure over a 50 or 75-year time period. What are we going to do? In terms of specific plans, I would defer to my colleagues who know more about international relocation policy, but they're thinking about it. Governments in the South Pacific are thinking about it.
Well, I'm glad somebody's thinking about it.
Well, there was kind of a classic case. It was a few years back, just before the Copenhagen meeting, that one of the prime ministers of one of these island nations held a press conference in scuba gear under the sea. It was a kind of a stunt, but it was quite a remarkable one. It got a lot of international press attention, and so somebody is thinking about this.
We welcome phone calls, and here's how you join our conversation. Paul Robbins is with us the first half hour of the show. Dr. Jane Goodall will join us the second half hour. Paul is director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and they are having a major conference, the 7th Annual Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference on Monday, April 15 in Madison. And the theme of the conference is conservation everywhere. Paul mentioned in our daily lives, too. I want to talk a little bit more about that. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He says our global environment is changing rapidly. There is no going back. We need now to be innovative, and we need to be adaptive. So let me ask you that question. How should we adapt, and how do we innovate when it comes to taking care of this planet? Phone lines are open. Short period of time to speak with Paul, so call now, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second part of this hour, Dr. Jane Goodall will be with us. She's going to keynote the Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. She, of course, is a world-renowned primatologist and conservationist, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, and she is also a UN messenger of peace. Let's go to phone calls for Paul Robbins, and let's start with Mary in Pewaukee. Hello, Mary.
Well, hello. Yeah, I think your station is cutting out a bit, but I wanted to first of all thank your guest very much for the education on global warming, and I can hear in his voice his passion for the subject. What can we as, you know, local homeowners around the country or the world do in our small way to help, you know, help this cause?
Great. Well, I'm happy to take that one. Almost every change that we make usually is a desirable one from the household point of view in terms of efficiency, getting things to run more cheaply. So if you think about your energy footprint, this is obviously a really obvious place where we in the United States are a little heavier per capita than everyone else. And it's not very difficult to reimagine some of our transportation needs or the way we get around using public transport or bicycles. I know this is sort of classic kind of environmental talk, enviro talk, but the truth is it's not that hard to make these kinds of transitions. And I would point out that even energy efficiency in vehicles, the way it's transformed in the last 5 to 10 years, has made a radical difference in what individual households are doing. The other part of it is that there's three pieces to it. There's energy. There's water. Our water use and our water demands, we can easily produce efficiencies in the household through basic practice. And then the third part is garbage. We produce a lot of garbage. I know my household has historically been bad on that front myself. And thinking a little bit about how to be more efficient is not a question about doing with less. It's simply a question about actually spending less on what we're doing.
Hmm. Thank you very much for the call, Mary. We should talk a wee bit, we haven't yet, about the big Earth Day conference where you landed Dr. Jane Goodall to be your keynote speaker. That was good work, Paul.
I'm really excited.
I imagine. She's just a treasure, isn't she?
I was an undergraduate here at the University of Wisconsin in the 1980s, and I can say without any exaggeration that she was one of the great inspirations for sending me into the field that I am now, and I'm sure I'm not alone in saying things like that.
I'm sure there are people all over the world who feel that way. So we should talk a little bit about the conference itself. It's on, and about Earth Day coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, just to get it out, it's open to the public. Registration is required. We're going to have lots of seats. We'll be up at Monona Terrace. Things are filling up fast. Jane Goodall is a big draw, such a public figure. But she's not going to be alone. It's an all-day conference. We have Céline Cousteau coming in, Jacques Cousteau's granddaughter and one of the important figures in ocean conservation. And we have Ken Bonning, who's coming in from Kohl's Corporation. And that's a company with noted successes in terms of sustainability initiatives and efficiency and greening the business system. So we have great keynotes even beyond Jane Goodall.
And it's open still. You can
absolutely
sign up.
Please go to nelson.wisc.edu, that Nelson website, and you'll see a link to Earth Day, and registration is wide open. So we please encourage people to come and join us. And of course, if you register and you want to see Jane Goodall, you can spend the rest of the day in panel sessions with people from the community, from businesses, and especially from the university here with lots of expertise, and we're going to talk about primate conservation and climate change, but some other things like film, using film and movies as a conservation tool, and about culture and ecology, you know, about the diversity of knowledges that we have around the world, people's cultures, that are really a resource for thinking about environmental sustainability.
Oh, it sounds like a greatly inspirational day, Paul.
Should be a lot of fun.
It should. Mary, thanks for the call. Jack in Kenosha, hi.
Hi. I was wondering your opinion of the effect of marine fish farming on the ocean.
Oh, boy. All right. In over my head, I'm a terrestrial ecology guy. What I would say is that fish farm, it's like most innovations. The great thing about innovations is that they usually cut both ways. So what we've seen with, I do know some shrimp farming, for example, in Vietnam, I know quite well, based on a graduate student's work. And what you see there is bumper crops of shrimp. And initially you would think, wow, that's great. That means less wild shrimp harvesting, more sustainability to the ocean system. But the problem with these intensive aqua farming systems is that they require huge inputs and are very vulnerable to disease, for example, because you've got populations that are kind of stuck there together in these farms, and the result is that you get boom and bust cycles. You have a lot of poor people who are driven off their own land, and by transforming some of these aquacultural sites in places like Vietnam, you actually lose the ability to maintain the mangroves and some of the land uses that traditionally were really, really important to the local ecology. So like most things, it cuts both ways. And as such, one of the things you've got to do is decide what you value more, which of the ecosystem services or values that might have to trade off against one another do you value most? And that's a question only, I think, the public can answer. I don't think that's something that science can answer in and of itself.
Mm. Didn't sound like you were in way over your head on that answer at all. Jack, thanks very much for the call. As we prepare to interview Dr. Jane Goodall, you said that she was a huge inspiration on you and was one of the people who made you decide that you were going to go into this field. Why did she have that impact on you? And, why did that happen?
I think here you had someone, you know, working on problems that were really important in terms of the environment. But when you saw her, and I got to say that this is the power of television documentaries that we all grew up with in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
When you saw her, it was her profound humanity that it just comes right through. It just comes right through. It's not like she's an alien off in some laboratory. She has a kind of rich human quality. And I think that may be some of the things that give her some of the optimism she has for the future and young people. And that just comes right through. And you know, I've never met her face to face.
Oh, you haven't?
But it comes, this is a big deal for me, too.
Oh, it is a big deal. And I think you're absolutely right that now being in the age of all these films available so readily on this whole internet, that we're seeing all of these species that we have the information right at our fingertips, and so it becomes immediate, and we're seeing things that we haven't had a chance to see before, and that must make a difference in this whole field, doesn't it, Paul?
I think it does, because there's a connection that people now can have 24/7, really, to environments around the world. You can go online and see a camera at a watering hole at a South African wildlife park. That's an incredible immediacy. The problem, of course, there's a two-edged sword to this as well, is that many of these experiences or documentaries are really mediated by the people who have to sell commercials and whatever else. So they want to tell a particular kind of story. They don't always get it exactly right, or they certainly lead you to certain kinds of feelings that are being, you're being manipulated. That's the nature of film. So we have to also be kind of careful. I always thought lemmings, for example, jumped off of cliffs. I learned that from a Disney nature film from the 1950s. The Disney guys ran those poor lemmings off the cliff. So one of the great myths that I believed until I was in graduate school.
We should also pay tribute to Gaylord Nelson, who was the founder of Earth Day, and your institute is named after him.
We're very proud to say so. Founder of Earth Day and a great senator from the state of Wisconsin. His desk is in my office. I'm not allowed to touch it. And it it looks at me every morning and says, what have you done today?
Well, I think you ought to be able to touch it at this point.
All right.
And tell me about the work of the Institute, Paul. It sounds like you're just doing all kinds of different things.
Well, the Institute, the first thing I'd say about it is it's an expression of the campus and the university writ large. We have 200 faculty affiliates, and they come from everywhere. They come from engineering, and they come from history, and they come from English, and they come from agriculture. So what we are is a kind of space or clearinghouse for the whole campus to do but not only science but communication and translation to the public. One of our signatures is our Center for Culture, History, and Environment, for example, and that's filled with historians and people studying literature and the humanities. And that's very unusual. There are many great environmental institutes around the country, but very few with that kind of signature on top of the excellent science. But I would say also the second thing that the institute's especially good at is thinking about the future of Wisconsin.
Mm.
So our Wisconsin mm-hmm. Initiative on Climate Change Impacts is a interdisciplinary campus-wide effort to think about what Wisconsin is going to have to do in the next 50 years to thrive in a changing environment. And that's at the disposal of anybody who wants to come and visit our website.
Oh, I'm glad you're doing that important work. Paul, thank you ever so much for being with us. And stay tuned. Dr. Goodall is with us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Robbins, director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. The mission is to address environmental change on many levels. As we said, Dr. Jane Goodall will be the keynote speaker at the Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. She's an extraordinary human being. She's a world-renowned primatologist and conservationist. She is founder of the Jane Goodall Institute. She is also a UN Messenger of Peace, known, of course, for her landmark study of chimpanzee behavior in Gombe National Park in Tanzania. And she is going to be doing the keynote speech. There will also be panel sessions focusing on primate behavior and conservation, climate change, and the list goes on. She remains hopeful about the future, even though we can have these kinds of conversations and become rather pessimistic. She has four reasons for hope, and she will explain those to us as we talk with her. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Dr. Jane Goodall is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dent Show. Dr. Jane Goodall, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
How in the world did you toss the coin at the Rose Bowl before we talk about these other things? I was so happy to see you there. I said to my family, there's Dr. Goodall.
Well, they chose me to be the Grand Marshal, and I said, well, I can't do that because it's family time. So they said, well, we'll bring your family. That's the first football game I've ever watched because I'm not into that sort of thing.
Well, you did a very nice job. Yeah, it was an unusual setting in which to see you. I'd like to, if we could, please, to go way back to the 1960s when you were 26 years old, I believe, and you went to Africa and you changed your life and changed the lives of many people around you as well. Can you talk about your early days in Africa, why you went?
Okay, well, I first fell in love with Africa when I was a child of 11, and we didn't have much money, and so I spent ages in secondhand bookshops because we couldn't afford new ones, and I found a little book called Tarzan of the Apes, and I just had enough money to buy it, and of course fell in love with Tarzan and was pretty jealous when he married the wrong Jane. That's when I decided I would go to Africa, live with animals, and write books about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know, we didn't have money. I couldn't go to university. But my mother suggested I did secretarial, and then perhaps I could get a job in Africa. So when I was invited for a holiday by a school friend, having earned my money as a waitress, I got out there, heard about the late Louis Leakey, went to the Natural History Museum, and because I'd been following my mother's advice and going on learning about animals in Africa, he offered me a job to start off as his secretary, let me go on a safari with him on to now famous Olduvai Gorge, realized that I really did want to be out in the bush with the animals, and somehow it seemed like home, and gave me this extraordinary chance to go and study not just any animal, but chimpanzees.
Hmm.
So, you know, I was 23 when I went out for the first time. Then I went home and I had to wait while he found the money and the permission for me to go start the study. And then, as you say, I was 26 when I began that study.
What did your mom think?
Well, my mother was the one who, when I was a child dreaming of Africa, when everybody else laughed at me, she said, if you really want something and work hard and never give up, you find a way. And when the authorities, it was British back then, you know, part of the colonial empire, and when they refused to allow me on my own, it was my mother who volunteered to come for the first 4 months. We had money for 6 months, and she came with me for the first four of those months. But not many mothers would do that.
No, they wouldn't. That's wonderful. I'm glad that you had that experience together. Wonderful. I know that I have read that in the 1980s, rampant deforestation had serious effects on chimpanzees that you were observing, and you shifted your focus from research to conservation. Is that still where your research is, Dr. Goodall?
Yes, we have a fantastic research team at Gombe. All the records going back to 1960 are now being looked after at Duke University, so they'll be available for students around the world. We're using cutting-edge technology for mapping and determining paternity and things like that. So it's great research going on. But I personally am spending 300 days a year on the road talking about habitat loss and hunting and, you know, climate change and pollution of air, water, and land, and how the unsustainable lifestyles of so many of us are, you know, unsustainable, and how there's crippling poverty in many parts of the world, and the human population is still growing, and there's a crazy notion that unlimited economic development is possible in a world with finite natural resources. So it's a mess.
And tell me about the effect. Obviously, it has effects on human beings, but tell me about the effects of the aforementioned issues on the chimpanzees that you have been living with and studying for so many years now. What's happened to the chimpanzee population?
Well, our particular chimp population at Gombe is doing okay. What happened was that all the forests from around the park disappeared totally.
Mm.
And it was a big shock when I flew over and realized that what had been unbroken forest all along the shores of Lake Tanganyika was now suddenly a small island of forest surrounded by bare hills. And that was a big shock. That's when I realized if we don't work to alleviate the poverty of the local people who are cutting down the last trees in their desperate effort to grow food for themselves, then we'll never be able to save the chimps. And this has worked. So the villagers around the park are now putting aside conservation land so that it forms a buffer around the tiny little 30-square-mile park. And the chimps today, within that area, they're still cut off from others, but they now have about three times more space because of the regeneration of the forest outside the park. And we're now starting leafy corridors moving towards other remnant chimp groups so that, you know, they theoretically will be able to move out, and you won't get the result of inbreeding.
Dr. Goodall, are there still chimps being... are poachers still capturing chimps and selling them on the black market?
Yeah, well, the biggest problem facing chimps overall in Africa is the bushmeat trade, and that's the commercial hunting of all wild animals for food, not mm-hmm. just subsistence, but, you know, so it's everything now, and you even shoot mother chimps.
Mm.
Or mother gorillas or mother elephants or whatever, which hunters wouldn't do in the past. So we're looking after orphan chimpanzees in our sanctuaries, as are others. And there is rather more than I thought, the live animal trade, which is still continuing, where mothers are deliberately shot simply to take the babies, usually for zoos, particularly in the Emirates and places like that, where it's high status to have a private collection of wild animals.
Mm. And when you talk about the poverty Tell me about the education programs, because I know there have been many that have taken place in the Gombe and in other areas. It's a huge issue. You obviously have to lift people's lives so they have enough to live on to change some of the horrible effects on the environment. What's happened in that regard?
Well, what's happened is that we've put an emphasis on women, and I think one of the main programs that we introduced with our program called Takari, which is improving the lives of the people living not only around the park but way outside along the lake where there's chimp habitat. And we introduced microcredit based on Mohamed Yunus's Grameen Bank. And this empowers women, and they start their own small environmentally sustainable programs. And we get as many scholarships as we can to keep girls in school, because, you know, if it's a very poor family, it's the boys that get the opportunity. And, of course, as women's education improves, so we find family size decreasing, and that's very important in these areas where, you know, there's way more people than the land can support if it goes on blossoming like this.
Isn't it remarkable how that microcredit can really change somebody's life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then on top of that, we have our youth program, Roots and Shoots, which began in Tanzania with 12 high school students. Basically, students concerned about what was going on in the world around them and wanting me to do something about it. And I said, hey, I'm not Tanzanian, you are. Let's get your friends together who feel the same and think about what you can do. And so Roots and Shoots is a program empowering young people. They choose what they want to do to make the world better, and they choose a project to help people, a project to help animals, including domestic animals, and a project to help the environment that we all share. So its main message, every single one of us makes an impact on the planet every single day. And this program is now in 133 countries with young people from kindergarten all the way through university and beyond. So it's one of the things I'm most passionate about, because, you know, we could you know, spend our entire lives fighting for the environment and conservation. But if we're not raising new generations to look after it better than we've done, there's no point.
I was interested in an article you wrote about what gives you hope, Dr. Goodall, and that was on the list for the young people that you meet every day and who are doing what you just described. You have faith in those who are coming behind us.
Yes, because I see once they know the problems and they are empowered to take action, it's that empowerment. Because if people are, you know, just thinking about all the problems and thinking, well, I'm just one, there's nothing I can do, then you do nothing. But if you're together with a group and, you know, you decide, well, I'm going to clean this stream and reintroduce the fish that once were here, and then you do it, and you know that young people all around the world are doing the same kind of thing, you know, this is very empowering.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Jane Goodall is our guest, and we welcome phone calls for her. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. She is going to be the keynote speaker at the 7th Annual Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. It's Monday, April 15, at Monona Terrace Community and Convention Center in Madison, and she is going to be talking about what gives her hope and about the extraordinary work that she has been doing for years and years and years. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Jane Goodall is our guest this part of the show, and we're welcoming some phone calls for her. Let's talk to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. Dr. Goodall, great respect for your work and for your intellectual honesty. I would ask you to comment just briefly on the subject of large undiscovered primates. kind of the Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti type of things. And as a scientist, what would you say about that? And do you believe it should be investigated seriously? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. Well, I'm a scientist, but I'm also, I guess, a romantic. I do not disbelieve in the presence of a large, as yet, non-scientifically identified primate, because I've read about them and talked to people who've seen them really all over the world, like, you know, Europe and China, Australia, all over US and South America. It's strange, but I'm not going to come out and say, I don't believe it, it's not possible. That's all I can say about that. I want it to be true.
I do, too. And I want people to come and visit us from another planet and teach us to be as wise as they are, because they're really good people. I'm a romantic in that regard as well. Thank you, Jeff, for your call. Willem in Colfax, hi. Willem, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Oh, yes. It's a pleasure to talk to Ms. Goodall. And she mentioned something about, protecting the loss of habitat. And in our state, what's happening in the region where I live in western Wisconsin, there's been this big push of sand mining, which is used in the hydraulic fracturing process. And whole ridges are clear cut and basically chewed from one end to the other. And all the animals that live there, all the voles and the moles and the squirrels and the badgers and on, and the deer, the fox, they all lose their habitat. Plus, the increased truck traffic makes it more likely that there'll be increased roadkill. And the other thing that's troubling to me is that our political system, our own Senator Ron Johnson, doesn't believe that climate change is happening. So that makes the problem very much more difficult when our leaders aren't leading. They're sort of contributing to the problem rather than helping.
Well, my comment on that is that having been to the places I've been and done the research that I've done, I don't understand how somebody can reject the notion that climate change is happening, because it's happening. Maybe there's a cycle, and maybe climate change would have happened anyway, but not the way it's happening now, so fast and affecting so many things. And the other problem, which you started with, it's our continued reliance on fossil fuels. And, you know, we have the brains, and we have the technology, that if all political will was bent to finding alternatives and producing them in a manner that people could use them, then we wouldn't have to do this appalling destruction of the environment that you talk about, which is happening all over. It was one of the things Rachel Carson bemoaned. I read a beautiful piece by her, sitting on a piece of land that she knew would soon not be there.
You have, getting back to this Reasons for Hope that you have written about, you say that all over the world you are seeing people who are making wiser choices, Dr. Goodall. What are those, and what are some of the choices that maybe we're not making that we need to?
Well, the thing is, my reasons for hope, we've touched on the energy and the commitment of young people. And then there's this incredible brain, which I've also mentioned, the kind of technology that we can produce. But at the same time, the biggest difference, I think, between us and our closest relatives, the chimpanzees, is the explosive development of the human intellect. I mean, quite clearly, the creature that sent a man to the moon and has a little robot crawling around Mars, you can't compare it even to the brightest chimpanzee, who can do things on a computer that we never used to believe. But how come that this intellectual creature, which is us, is destroying its only home? It's crazy. Mm-hmm. So it's as though there's a disconnect between the head and the heart, and we have to start making decisions based on how will the decision we make today affect our people generations ahead. What is it going to be like for our children if we carry on with business as usual. What's it going to be like for a child in 100 years when all the forests and all the ridges and all the animals have either disappeared or they're close to extinction, and that child can only look at what used to be in a book and say, why did you let it happen? So the kind of choices I'm thinking about are, you know, for most of us, the small choices. What do you buy? Where did it come from? How many miles has it had to travel? Can you buy it closer by? How many pesticides were used? Was it genetically modified? Clothes that you buy, were they made with child slave labor in China or India or something like that?
Yes.
And if you start thinking like that, you automatically start making those small changes in your lifestyle. The heavy meat eating is causing unbelievable environmental destruction. Forests cut down to graze the cattle, the amount of water you need to transfer vegetable protein to animal protein, never mind the cruelty, and the antibiotics regularly used that are now making bacteria build up resistance so that people are beginning to die from these superbugs. So just learn about what you're doing each day and make choices that are good for the environment and the future of the planet.
Let's go to Paul. Willem, thanks for the call. Paul in Evansville. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Goodall.
Good morning, or yes.
Hi. I was quite pleased to hear that you're still alive. I didn't realize that.
I am. I'm nearly 80, but I'm still going strong.
I appreciate the subject you're talking about, although it bums me out big time. My question... I'm not sure if I have this right, but I think there's a species of chimpanzee that are called bobos.
Bonobo.
Is that correct?
Yeah, bonobo.
And what difference is there between them and other chimpanzees that we're familiar with?
Okay, well, they're actually not a chimpanzee. There are the four great apes, well, five great apes, actually. The chimpanzee, the one I study, which is all over Africa, or it was, it's disappearing now. And then there's the gorilla, also in Africa, the little bonobo in Africa, and the orangutan in Asia. And the bonobo is actually very different from the chimp. They make different sounds. They have a very different social life, and sex is very important to them. The female remains receptive to the males almost the whole of her life, except when she's just suckling for the first few months. They're basically less aggressive than the chimpanzees, so they're just different.
Thank you, Paul, for the call. She's not only very much alive, she is very much alive. And just to reiterate, she will be the keynote speaker at the 7th Annual Nelson Institute Earth Day Conference. And that's taking place in Madison on April 15. And you are still traveling. You travel all over the world, as you said, 300 days a year. Why do you do that kind of vigorous travel?
Well, you know, in one way you could say, well, there's Jane. Is she walking her talk if she's doing all that travel and using up all that fuel? But, you know, it's the only way at the moment that I can get from A to B.
Yes.
And so many people say, well, Jane, I read all your books and I saw films, but when you came and talked, it just made me feel completely different.
Oh.
So, and, you know, I'm trying to grow the Roots and Shoots program at the same time and meet with, you know, people who can perhaps be influential. And so I don't know how much longer I'll be able to do it. So I feel that it's very important, since it is making an impact, or at least that's what I'm told, that I better do it while I can.
Mm-hmm. Paul Robbins, who we just interviewed, who's director of the Nelson Institute, said that you were the person who made him do what he's doing in his life, and he's never met you personally, so he's very excited about having you in Madison, and I'm sure many others are as well. It must, on some level, although you're a fairly modest woman, be good to know that you have made a huge impact. You've made a huge impact.
Well, and it's very peculiar to me, you know. So the only way I can cope with it is to, well, there's two Janes. There's this one, me, you know, going around being, I'm just me. And then there's a Jane that's out there and having this impact on people. I mean, every single day somebody says, I do what I do because I read your book when I was 12 or something like that.
Oh, yes.
And the children who write, this is what I like best, the children who write to me from, you know, China and well, all over, and say, you taught me that because you did it, I can do it too.
Ah, that's wonderful. Jane Goodall, our guest this half hour. She is going to be the keynote speaker at the Nelson Institute's 7th Annual Earth Day Conference in Madison, April 15. Couldn't think of a better way to spend a day. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Katie Mattson for producing.